I'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Brown, have you read the minutes of the... Oh, we haven't got a quorum. All right, then, where's Representative Bly?
I'm ready.
Now we have a quorum. Representative Brown, would you move the minutes of the 24th?
Yes, Madam Chair, after reading them thoroughly, I do move the minutes of the 24th.
Representative Brown moves the thoroughly read February 24th minutes. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Welcome, Representative Bly. It's nice to have the bill author be so timely available. And did you ask a member to move your bill, or should I move it?
I have not asked.
I'll move House File 2748 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Garling. Essentially, what this bill attempts to do is to restore some funding, provided there is funding available, to alternative programs and programs that used to use this extended time to meet the needs of their students. I just wanted to mention that last evening I attended a presentation by a Dr. Robert Anda talking about the effects of trauma on children ages up to age 5 in the early childhood realm. And it was very interesting to me because of many of the things he was talking about that resulted in later problems or later difficulties were the exact problems that we find in our alternative schools. And one of the things that he talked about in how to remedy this or how to work on this, he cited some schools in Pennsylvania that are called trauma-aware care schools. And as he described what they were doing, it reminded me that this is exactly what Minnesota's alternative schools and area learning centers have been trying to do with students who've had extreme trauma in their early years and result in behaviors that make school success very difficult. And I know that when we used to have the extended time, it meant that the things that we knew how to do with students who had suffered early trauma or had the kinds of behaviors that result from that, we were able to make even more, have more success with them the longer that we could work with them. And in my own program, and I have Steve Allen here, who is the president of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. He'll speak for a few minutes about the bill as well. But we were both managed alternative schools and learned that, you know, we could develop different programs that would extend the kinds of things that we could do with students. And one of the things that we both had in our programs were programs for teen mothers and or teen parents. And this is another way of being able to prevent further trauma in families and young children, because what we were attempting to do with that was to help these young parents learn how to be better parents so that the difficulties they'd had as children perhaps wouldn't persist and be problems for their children, and they'd get a good start in school. And at any rate, I just wanted to pass on some of those experiences that I've had that I think are really important and argue for why extended time funding is so important for these kinds of programs. So I would ask my testifier to speak further on them.
Thank you very much, Representative Bly. Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, my name is Steve Allen. I am a retired administrator from Oakland Area Learning Center and the past president of Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on extended general education revenue for state-approved alternative programs. I would like to talk about the extended time revenue, what it is and how it's utilized by state-approved alternative programs. I would also like to note that the proposed language change will have no cost implications for the current biennium. Upon their inception, Area Learning Center were initially granted the ability to provide additional educational services for at-risk students above and beyond the regular school day. If you think of a full-time student as being one full-time equivalent or ADM, in the correct terms, one full-time membership, the student can generate aid above and beyond this. Extended time is the instruction that is provided in the evening, after school, during the summer. Aid is allocated on a prorated basis. Initially, the maximum amount was capped at 1.5 many years ago. This was later reduced to 1.2 equivalents at a recommendation of the department. Approximately 6 years ago, the base formula was frozen at 4601. over the past few years, our organization has been on a roller coaster trying to get this changed. In the process, we've sought and received support from various organizations. I thought we had it in the bag last year when we got the school boards to back us on it, and the school boards association, and even the department. And each year, we've been extremely disappointed at the end of the legislative session when we're told that our bill, or the bill that they had the language changes attached to it, had been cut or traded off in the Joint Conference Committee. One of the areas of emphasis that I felt the legislative auditor's report could have spent more time on was the role of alternative education with intervention. Intervention services are very, very important for at-risk kids. This is one of the most important services that's statewide. Everybody's got a credit makeup program. It's an area where oftentimes the regular school and the high school work collaboratively together, or the regular school and the alternative school. That's really important. When at-risk students fail, we all lose. And as they get farther and farther, they lose hope. And if they lose hope again, we all lose. It's really important that we give them the time that is needed. The legislative auditor's report made it very clear that's all some students need is more time. Some students can graduate in 3.5 years from a four-year high school. Some students will graduate in 4 years, and some will take longer. We have students who will be in our in credit makeup programs just about every semester, every summer. We see them come back every year, and they graduate on time. And that's really, really important. Under the 1.2 cap, a student can technically earn 3 credits during a course of the year above and beyond the full-time status. It's not easy for those kids. A lot of people think it's free lunch. They're going to school full-time during the day. They're going to classes in the evening time. They're going summers. You really have to give them credit. When the student goes over the 1.2, basically we don't get any aid for them. But many schools continue to provide the credit makeup, even though the alternative school knows they're going to get no aid for those students, because they're trying to do two things. They're trying to help the kids graduate, and they're trying to make sure that the kids don't give up hope. And that's really, really important. When this was written many years ago, Senator Peeler made a comment that I'll never forget. He said, you can either pay for it now or pay for it later. Take your pick. And that's one of the most accurate statements, you know, that I've remembered over the years. Targeted services is another extended time service that the legislative auditor's report referenced. The report showed that the progress of these elementary and middle school students are making as a result of some additional time and smaller classes. People say, what magic do you do? We don't have magic. We have the luxury of smaller classes. We have the luxury of being able to try things differently. And we have the luxury of giving kids more time. Because extended time revenue has been frozen over the past 2 years, I've watched targeted service classes grow. When I first started targeted service classes many years ago, average class size was 10 to 12 students. When I retired last year, many of our classes were hitting about 24 students. When you increase the class sizes, you lose the ability to do things differently. You lose the ability to individualize, to personalize, and that's really what it's all about. In closing, I'd like to encourage you to support the language change for extended time services. We've seen results through our graduation rates and test scores. Students who take advantage of extended time services are staying in school and improving their academic skills. Extended time programming is one of the best things that we do, and it levels the playing field for some kids. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Questions from members on this bill? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bly, any thought of where this money will come from?
Representative Bly, and before we, before Representative Bly answers that question, Representative Biskins, actually, Mr. Crow tells us there is no fiscal note at all on this bill, because unless you know something I don't know, we're not raising the formula this year. So to link something to the formula when there's no increase in the formula garners a zero fiscal note. But I'm assuming you mean when we are raising the formula sometime in the hopefully near future. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, thank you for that clarification. No, I guess I was looking at the effective date, which of course is within this biennium, but without a raise in the formula, you've answered my question. Thank
you. Very good. Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to echo the concern that Representative Biskins brought up is that anytime we adjust these formulas, they, you know, we're putting an inflation factor in this. We're automatically dialing up spending in the future. And while the was Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom are correct that there's going to be no increase in the per pupil funding formula, this seems to it does put more pressure on the expenditure side of things. And the concern I have, and Representative Bligh, you can feel free to address it, is that right now we have no definition of a basic day or a basic week. So when we're putting in extended time, that's not universal. What is qualifying for extended day revenue in one school district is just part of the normal school day in other school districts. And that would seem that that would be an important part of this definition, is that if we're paying more, which we would do under this plan, we should have sort of a minimum standard or a minimum guarantee. If you could address that, or Mr. Allen could address that.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, when you look at the calculations for ADMs, it's based on the 1,020 unit. And I can know this for a fact because I oftentimes lost money on extended time services. Here's how it works. You are absolutely right that there's no definition. But if a school district comes in and I take a student from their school district and they're under the 1,020, I get no aid. I service that student free until they hit 1,020. On my ADM reports, every year I lost about 10 ADMs on that adjustment. And so what I'm telling you is that 1,020 is the ADM adjustment, and we don't get extended time revenue until after a student generates that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Mr. Allen, I don't know what you mean by 1,020. Can you explain that?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, 1,020 is the equivalent that they use for accounting our full-time ADM for our programs, because many of our programs are utilize an independent study model, and so we count every hour. So 1,020 hours of instruction is equivalent to a full-time equivalent or an ADM.
Okay.
Any? Don't see anybody else on the list. You're not done.
Yeah,
Mr. Garofalo.
If that's okay, Madam Chair.
Please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Crow, maybe you can speak legislator for us because I'm confused. I'm not pitching this up. The 1,020 represents the number of hours of normal instruction or extended time instruction?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Representative Garofalo, the 1,020 is assuming back when we defined the length of the school year, there were required to be 170 days, and the time period for the secondary students was 6 hours per day. So the 1,020 hours is derived from the old definitions that were in rule and statute regarding the length of the school year. Prior to 1996, when we had the length of the school year, we required 170 instructional days and 175 total days for state aid. So a school district could have up to five professional days, but needed 175 school days in order to generate the full amount of state aid. When we eliminated the hours requirement in state rule and eliminated the minimum number of school days, essentially what happened is school districts went to their own calendars and they're frozen at the 96-97 level of days, so they need to go as many instructional days as they had in 1996 and 97.
Okay, so Madam Chair and Mr. Strom, so if I understand it right, individual school districts are tied to that 96 date, so I was confused there for a moment because it sounded like what I thought was in law was not in law, and that is that there is no minimum guarantee. We still have situations where extended time revenue is given to school districts where other school districts have included as part of their basic school day.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think Mr. Allen's point is that in certain circumstances when students transfer into other kinds of programs like an alternative learning program, that 1,020 hours needs to be met before that program can start counting extended time for that student.
Thank you.
Any testimony for or against the bill? Closing statement from, there is one person. Okay, come forward. This bill, we're going to end at 3:05. We need time for the author's statement, so it needs to be a short comment. If you could state your name for the record and welcome.
Yes, Chair. My name is Rick Heller. I thought I'd come up. I've been doing research on targeted services. Maybe this is part of that. Might not do with policy, might be do with finances. I find a hard linkage between on these reports districts generate. I used an iPad request to look at those reports. I looked at 30 of them approximately, and it was very, very vague. And my concern always has been, how do they link the holes where these kids are struggling? You know, a lot of kids use repetitions, extended school year, et cetera. They get caught up with their peers, or at least maintained, because that's one of the things important about extended school year or summer school. And I just don't see that linkage out there, how that's affected. I know last week you had a one-year study done on it. I've discussed with this gentleman about that. I thought there was an inconsistency about how it was so specific as far as how it helps the kids individually, because every kid has a unique need. Just because they haven't been identified for special ed, and we wouldn't like them to be obviously in the least restrictive environment with them.
Mr. Heller, the topic of this bill is whether or not to link extended time to the formula or not. So if you could keep your remarks. Do you support extended time revenue, or are you speaking for or against the bill?
I support revenue when you can support intervention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Closing statement, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Greiling. And I hope members would consider voting for this bill. It does give us, as alternative educators, the opportunity to meet the needs of students, and as Mr. Allen said so eloquently, keeps them hopeful about their success. And it really matters being able to deliver what they need early in their education system, in their career, rather than waiting years afterwards or having them come back year after year. So it is really a very useful tool for us to make sure that students are successful.
Thank you very much. And this is part of the new Minnesota miracle, which we're not getting to very fast. And this is something that wouldn't have a fiscal note, could actually be done this year. So thank you so much. Representative Biskins. And while Representative Biskin's coming up, for his time management as well as for the audience planning, and depending on which bill you're here for, unless you're here for both, Representative Biskins, it's my intention to take half of the remaining time for your bill and half of the remaining time for Representative Dabney's bill. And you don't have to take the whole amount of time, but we will cut you off at 3:40 if you're not done by then. Representative Biskins.
Madam Speaker, you, or Madam Chair, you could cut me off at 3:08 because I will be done.
And Representative Biskins, if you would like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 3003 be recommended be included in the Omnibus K-12 Finance Bill.
Representative Biskins moves House File 3003 for possible inclusion. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the bill before you, I believe, corrects an inequality that currently exists, one that exists solely because of interpretation and not because of either the Constitution or state law. Madam Chair, members, I believe that the Permanent School Trust Fund was a fund established to support the education of our public school students in the state of Minnesota. Our public school students in the state of Minnesota, and currently we have a large segment through interesting interpretations of law are excluded from the support of the Permanent School Trust Fund, and those are students who are in charter schools. If you look at, Madam Chair, members, I added into your packet a copy of Article 11, Section 8 of the Minnesota Constitution, the document we were we swore to uphold. If you look at the last sentence of the last paragraph, it's the first paragraph, it says the net interest and dividends arising from the fund shall be distributed to the different school districts of the state in the manner prescribed by law. When members, this was written, right, the different school districts of the state, right, encompassed every single public school student. That was the intent, obviously, of our founders, was to include every single public school student. We go a little further in law, members, by looking at the bill itself. If you look at line 1.7 of House File 3003, you can see that in current statute, we actually list what those school districts are. So obviously, members, it is the right of the legislature to decide what those school districts are that the Constitution lists as the different school districts. This bill simply says that, in all practical purposes right now, a charter school is treated as a school district. We believe charter schools should be treated as a school district when it comes to the disbursement of the permanent school trust fund. The commissioner has not made that leap, and so we are helping the commissioner make that leap. Members, I understand that the permanent school trust fund is a zero-sum game. Now, the money that goes to one school has to come from somewhere else, and so in your packet is a straight-up run of how this would affect all schools. And I believe the worst-hit school district in this packet comes to about $11 per student. So it is, hopefully not too onerous. I understand every penny counts, but Madam Chair, I've gone over my 3 minutes self-allotted, and so I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Biskens, you were very concise, and and did you reference this legal opinion? Is that in all of our packets here? Oh, okay. Okay, so maybe that Ms. Kelleher is going to bring that up when she testifies. Okay, so I guess I'll wait for that as long as she's brought a legal opinion. Representative Biskens, it's my opinion that you brought a good bill, and if you had asked me to sign on, I would have. You could have made it another Biskens-Greiling bipartisan bill. You missed an opportunity.
Madam Chair, I apologize.
Apology accepted. At least you let me sign on your rulemaking bill last week. So, questions from members. Representative Slocum.
I don't have a question so much as an endorsement. I think this is a great bill, and it's an opportunity to act in a fair way. And I'd like to have a roll call on this.
Representative Slocum has asked for a roll call. We're laying it over.
Sorry.
We're both trying to get to the markup of the bill today, Representative Slocum. But in all good time. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Question on the part where on the revenue distribution from pupils served instead of resident pupils. Now, I don't know if this is a question for staff also, but the dollars follow the student, but like on a referendum, does that apply to resident students? I mean, what's the difference here? Maybe staff can
members, these two staff people, we always get them mixed up, which one knows what. But notice their name tags today, just to get us all the more confused. But I guess it's for Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Marquardt. We use different formulas to calculate different revenue amounts, but nearly all of our formulas are based on the students served, the adjusted average daily membership count. The primary formula that's not is the referendum formula, and that's based on the resident pupil count. But that's really the about the only place that the resident pupil count is used other than on the permanent school fund money, and in part that's a historical legacy up until this year. Payments of the permanent school fund simply reduced the school district state aid, and since it didn't matter to school districts, it wasn't revenue for them, it was just an offset against state aid, there was never any move to change that back when other pupil counts were changed. And these changes stemmed from the mid-90s when the open enrollment and other systems had been in place for a few years. And instead of paying the revenue to the resident district, which is what we used to do, and adjusting it for students moving in or out, the counts changed, and we pay the revenue now directly based on the students served for most of the other counts of revenue, for most of the other general ed and other revenue programs.
Representative Depke.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Actually, I was going to see if Representative Biskins would mind if I asked Representative Slocum a couple of questions on the charter school. Okay, because I know you are the...
He yields to Representative.
Do you yield to... Okay. You're the queen of charter schools. We passed a lot of legislation last year on which you did a yeoman's job, a two-year study. Why didn't you bring this forward?
Representative Slocum.
Volume of information. That's the best excuse I can give. I wish I would have. I congratulate Representative Biskins for doing this. And actually, he and I worked together quite closely in a very nice bipartisan way last year.
Representative Biskins is a nice man.
More blessed.
And I...
Representative...
I'm blushing. We're not on TV today, are we, Shannon?
We both are.
Representative Slocum, are you finished?
No. I don't talk much, but when I do, look out. I don't want to be the queen. I want to be the princess.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I could apologize. I could call you the princess.
Oh, my gosh. We got dairy princesses on the House floor today. This is getting to be way too much.
Yes, it is.
Is that it? Or?
No, I've got one more. I'm sorry. I won't be as gushy on this one. Representative Biskins, could you tell me how do other states do this, or is this are we setting a precedence, or is this something new? I haven't really heard of this before.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, Representative Depke, I can't speak to other states. I know that the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota probably are amongst the finest people in the state of Minnesota or in the United States. And so when they do see a wrong, they want to right it right away. I'm not sure that's true in other states, but I know it's true in Minnesota.
Do other states know? Okay. Representative Depke.
Thank you. Just one more question. And how does this change the relationship between the authorizer and the school district? It was my understanding from the testimonies that we heard last year that part of the private funding that goes to charter schools, and correct me if I'm wrong, is part of it is that the authorizer comes in and controls that as well. So is this going to change anything regarding the authorizer relationship with the school or the private funding and the corporation's relationship with the schools?
Representative Biskins.
In a short answer, absolutely not.
Representative Depke, is that it for you?
I'll get to him later.
Okay. We all know where to find him.
Madam Chair, to elaborate on that, it would change. It would have absolutely no effect on the relationship any more than us increasing the per pupil revenue and the formula revenue in any year would change the relationship between the school and the authorizer. So the amount of revenue doesn't change that relationship at all.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you. This is likely a question for staff. Representative Garofalo and I think it's fair to say, are confused on a bipartisan basis.
I figured it out for you.
I'm not sure that's the answer, though. We're trying to understand why the differences in impact on traditional school districts. And at first, I thought it was the difference between resident ADM and served ADM, but that seems to be part of the answer, but not the full answer. And I'm wondering if staff could explain, or Representative Garofalo explain.
Miss, which one of the staff?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Crow.
The difference between resident pupils and pupils served is pupils that leave for various reasons, whether it's open enrollment, charter school attendance, anything like that that changes the number of kids in the residing in the district versus being served at the public school in the district. So a district that loses a lot of kids to open enrollment, for example, would have a higher resident count than they have a served count, so they would have get relatively less revenue under this proposal. And, you know, and the point of the bill, you know, if there's a district, say, has 100 of its kids go to a charter school in that district, that money, this money then would be paid to the charter school instead. So if that was the only thing happening in the district, the school district would lose the revenue tied, the permanent school fund revenue tied to those 100 kids, and it would end up going to the charter school that was serving those kids.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Crow, Madam Chair, Mr. Crow, thank you. But Minneapolis, the difference between resident and served is 27%, and we would lose $11 per pupil per ADM under this proposal. St. Clair, number 75 on the list, the difference is 53%, so significantly larger than Minneapolis's, yet they lose $10 per ADM. It doesn't seem quite as it doesn't seem quite as straightforward. I'm trying to understand how the formula is working to yield differential impacts. What am I missing?
And thank you for bringing that up, Representative Dabney. Maybe we could have some interpretation of this this handout that we have from House Research when they get done conferring. And, of course, when you have money follow the pupil, then there is a loss to those losing the pupil. Maybe while they're doing that, why don't we hold on that? We'll get back. Are you ready?
I think there's an explanation here that probably won't sit well with folks, which is the denominator can be inconsistent in some ways about whether it's the resident or the served denominator. So the bigger on that per pupil, because if you look at the if you look at St. Clair's loss in or gain rather in total dollars, that 5,000 gain is on a different base because we've got to use either resident or served as the denominator, and so you're going to get a slightly different number, I think, based on that. So I think that may be the explanation because as I understand it, your point is, gee, if a 27% change, regardless of which direction it goes in Minneapolis, is $11 per kid, why isn't a 50% change more than 10? And the reason is that we had to choose one column or the other to be the denominator, and we're using the resident since that's current law, so we're using the resident as the denominator. So the Minneapolis change is based on that bigger pupil count. So if you were to do a percent change, what percent is the 352,000 of the 1.1 million in Minneapolis? You'd get a different number than a different percent than that would match that student percent. But it's just because it's a mathematical quirk because we don't have a base that's the same in both cases.
So Madam Chair, if it's an inconsistent choice, could in the case of Minneapolis, could they choose the St. Clair base so that we would gain money out of this proposal like they do rather than lose money?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I think the point is, regardless of which base we show that last column on, the Minneapolis district will lose $352,000, and whatever percent or dollars per kid that is, we can give you several different numbers for what that percent of dollars per kid is, depending on which base we use. But the net is still the net, that it's a $352,000 loss.
Okay.
And Madam Chair.
Dang, I thought I was onto something there.
And remember, if you're comparing, I would compare the districts with the same sign, because those districts will have the same denominator. If you compare Minneapolis at 27.2 with, I just had one. With a positive district, pick one that's close. The number, no, those are different signs, so the numbers is going to be different. So if you look at two that have the same sign, the dollar will reflect the percentage change comparatively than if you do with different signs because of that denominator issue. If you look at Pine Point and Black Duck, they're at negative 19 and negative 18, and their dollar difference is 5 and 4. So they're going to be similar if the sign is the same and if the percentage is similar, the dollar change is going to be similar.
So we have to know our positives and negatives and percentages to figure this out. Why don't we bring up Grace Kelleher for testimony, and followed by Gene Piccolo. And is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the School Boards Association. This issue has come before the legislature before, and we participated in discussions on this going forward. Members, we have a concern about charter schools receiving this funding. And if you go back to what Representative Biskins referred to in Section 11, Subsection 8 of the Constitution, that last sentence he noted, we feel, really describes the difference because it refers to school districts. And the Constitution provides permanent school fund to school districts. The legislature by statute does not have the constitutional authority to appropriate that revenue to entities other than school districts. Stating that an entity be treated like a school district or in the same manner as a school district or as though it were a school district does not make that entity a school district. In that case, in the case of charter schools, they are cooperatives or nonprofit corporations that the legislature has stated are public schools. They are not, however, school districts any more than a nonprofit corporation providing education, such as a non-public or parochial school, are school districts. The legislature cannot avoid the requirement of the Constitution by defining an entity that is not a school district to be a school district. So thank you, Madam Chairman. I will try to answer questions.
Thank you. Ms. Kelleher, do all the members have the legal opinion that I have, Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chairman, I would be happy to provide the members. It is an old opinion from 2008. So some of the points with the changes we enacted last year for the trust fund have been negated. But I'd be happy to share that with members.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Benson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Oh, Ms. Kelleher, after you read that, I was just wondering, in districts which are mentioned in the Constitution, are school buildings within those districts participating in the school funding that they receive from this particular source? Individual buildings, students there, do those individual buildings participate in using these funds? What I'm getting at is that charter schools are considered public schools, and simply because they are an entity independent, I guess, of the administration of a school district, they still are part of what we consider the public school system. And so I'm just wondering why you differentiate buildings or groups of teachers and students and consider them separate from the other buildings and students and staff in the public school districts.
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, that's a very good question. When we became a state, this became part of our state constitution. It actually was in, as they were thinking of making Minnesota a state, in our Organic Act, that the 16th and 32nd parcels of every county would be dedicated to school districts, mm-hmm. with the idea in the 1800s that the school district was a one-room school district, and we had very few people in Minnesota at that time, so it didn't instantly produce school districts or recognize one type. As Representative Dietrich can attest to, as we went through this statute not only prescribes how the funds should be used, but prescribes how land should be sold in order to process proceeds to school district. And the easiest example I can think is, it says in here that we can only sell any of our 2.5 million acres at public auction. We had hoped for a long time that we could find some better transactions that might make the trust have more funds in it, whether it be a private sale or post a sale at a realtor. And that's not prescribed. The only way we can get that change is to go back and get a constitutional amendment to say that. And I suggest that was the way, that's the way this problem should be fixed, is through a constitutional amendment. Or by the legislature saying we want to recognize charter schools that way and giving another defined fund to match the trust fund land revenue. We certainly would support all those attempts, but there is a finite difference when it comes to the Constitution that we feel is not represented in this bill.
Just a follow-up.
The charter schools are considered public schools, are they not?
They are.
And do you think the, thank you, Madam Chair, do you think the intent of the Constitution was to provide resources for public schools and their and the children who attend them?
I'll call on Ms. Kelleher in a minute, but I think Representative Benson, Ms. Kelleher, and the School Board Association are interpreting state law, you know, rather than just trying to cut out the charter school students. And I think, you know, that might be
a difference
in the discussion here. So I don't want to have that kind of a debate as much.
All right.
As,
I won't pursue that.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Any other questions for Ms. Kelleher? Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the to Representative Benson's point, Ms. Kelleher is actually interpreting constitutional law, and it does state very clearly in section Article 11, Section 8, it says, to the different school districts of the state. And so that is what we have always went by and used as we work on school trust lands. Is we use this constitutional piece a lot. And so I too would wonder why Representative Biskins didn't bring a constitutional amendment forward.
And Representative Dietrich, I think that is the question, and that is what I meant to say, constitutional law. And I think if we go down this road, we may find out if it's constitutional or not, but let's ask Mr. Representative Biskins.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Dietrich. I am not a lawyer, but I did sweep at a Holiday Inn once. members, to the legal opinion being quoted here, you do need to know that it was written by Mr. Tom Deans, who is paid legal counsel for the school board. All right, this was not an unbiased legal opinion. Let's start with that. To the idea that the legislature has no right to define a district is preposterous in and of its face. I find it very interesting. And I was just handed this legal opinion as I was walking to the table. It wasn't afforded to me to actually study or I'd have the exact dates. But I find it interesting that this legal opinion does not speak at all to Minnesota Statutes 123A.55. If you look at the bill, that's what we're talking. If you look at 123A.55, you notice that the legislature does indeed define districts as common, as independent, or special districts. Now, members, like I said, had I seen this earlier, I would tell you when this statute was written, but I'll bet you it was written far after the Constitution was actually written. Therefore, to say that the legislature cannot define a school district is preposterous. But, Madam Chair, members, the School Board Association has given me some homework. I promise I will get you the date when this section of statute was first written, and you can see for yourself.
And Representative Biskins, I'm sure you will do that. And looking in the Constitution, it does say for the use of schools. You know, school districts has gotten in there. In my, I'm not an attorney either, obviously, but it looks like the district versus schools came in statute, not in the Constitution. But anyway, any other questions on any other topics for Ms. Kelleher? And otherwise, we'll bring down Mr. Piccolo. Mr. Piccolo.
Mm-hmm.
Details. Welcome, Mr. Piccolo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we would support this bill. I think the issue of whether a charter school is a district or not, in Minnesota Statute 124D, the charter school law, it states that a charter school district is a district for the purposes of tort liability. So the legislature has, for different purposes, if you go through the whole charter school law, indicated at different times for different purposes that a charter school is a law, a charter school is a district. And if you look at 124D11, which is the charter school funding, subdivision 6 says other aids, grants, and revenue. A charter school is eligible to receive other grants, aids, and revenues according to chapters 120A through 129C as though it were a district. The permanent school fund is distributed through statute 127-3234. So therefore, it falls within those statutes, and we would argue that charter schools should be getting the permanent school funding.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. And before we see if anyone has any questions for you, the staff has pointed out that I'm looking at the Constitution, the beginning of this section, and the later section does say, it says it's for the use of schools within each township, but then later it says that the fund shall be distributed to the different school districts of the state. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they in turn couldn't turn around and give it to schools, it seems to me. So, anyway, questions for Mr. Piccolo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other testimony? Anyone? Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, this isn't to the issue. I just wanted to welcome Mr. Piccolo back mm-hmm. in the legislature. It's awfully good to see you again, Gene, and look forward to continue working with you.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Biskins, closing statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As a closing statement, I will thank my friend, and if he was a school classmate of mine, my fellow homework buddy, for providing me the statute book. And just for the members' information, 123A.55, which defined school districts as common, independent, or special, was first written into law in 1959. So in 1959, far after the Constitution was written, the legislature did understand that we have the power to define a school district. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. Representative Dabney. Representative Biskins has contributed 6 minutes to you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Biskins. Actually, I do think that there is a segue here between the two bills, and I'll get to that. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2910 to be before the committee.
Representative Dabney moves House File 2910 for possible inclusion. Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Members, I'd like to start explaining House File 2910 by explaining what it isn't. It does not alleviate the state from the responsibilities that it has taken on for the transportation of non-public school students or charter school students safely to and from their homes and schools each day. It does not unilaterally repeal the mandate. The traditional public schools participate and carry, and transport charter and non-public school students. It even maintains the mandate that traditional school districts provide transportation for charter school students that are more robust opportunities for transportation than the services that the traditional school district may provide its own students. What House File 2910 does is place before this legislature the question of who should pay for that state mandate and pay for the transportation of charter and non-public students to school. Should traditional school districts be required to subsidize the transportation costs of their competitors, or should they be allowed to compete on a level transportation playing field? In Representative Biskin's bill presentation, he argued that charter schools should be treated as school districts. This bill accomplishes then that same goal, treating charter schools as school districts responsible for the costs of transporting their own students, and also goes to the question of who bears the costs of the state mandate for the transportation of non-public schools. With me today are a number of testifiers. I'd like to start with Mr. Charlie Kite.
Welcome, Mr. Kite.
For the record, I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll testify very quickly and then introduce the next two people, if that's okay with you.
That sounds
good. Representative Dabney shared the overlay of this. I will tell you that we have had the public schools and the non-public schools of Minnesota and the charter schools have had long-term attempts to have good cooperative relationships. And you know, if we were in a situation right now where there was more than enough money to fund the public schools, this bill would not be in front of you. But the reality is we're under a lot of economic stress, and we've got a very scary feeling that it's going to get worse. We are paying for the transportation of non-public and charter school students. In some cases, it does not cost more than the state aid provided us. In other cases, we have school districts that don't have any charter or non-public students that they transport. But we do have a number of schools where not only are we transporting the non-public and charter students, but because of the location of buildings and the routing of buses, it costs significantly more than the aid that is generated to pay for transportation of students. On the handout you have, I'll flip to the back side very quickly. It just gives you, this is a very short survey. These are not all the schools. We just try to dipstick a few. But you can see, for instance, in Fairmont, they're paying $131,000 a year out of their general fund, out of their basic formula, in order to subsidize this excess cost. Centennial School District, $73,000 a year. Rochester, $540,000 a year. We have people here from Fergus Falls and Anoka-Hennepin. I would put one correction in here. Under Anoka-Hennepin, it says $756,000. We have reanalyzed that number. It's actually $630,000. We don't want to fluff these numbers up. Their cost per student is $221. So with that, I would like to ask you if you would take some brief testimony from Mark Maston. He's the business manager at Fergus Falls, and from Keith Paulson. He's the transportation director at the Anoka-Hennepin School District. Afterwards, if you'd like, we'll stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Kite. Mr. Maston.
Thank you very much. Mark Maston, business manager of Fergus Falls Public Schools. Was asked me put together these numbers for you. In Fergus Falls, we probably have what I would say open enrollment rampage in our school district. I have four elementary non-public schools. I have two neighboring school districts that are competing for kids. They run their buses through our school district. And whereas most school districts may be able to limit who gets to ride the bus, either elementary kids from 1 mile or secondary 2 mile, Fergus Falls can't do that. We have to go from 0 mile, and that's because the moment we say no to a kid, our neighboring school districts will also just send in a bus and pick up the kid and take him over to their school district. And obviously, with that kind of revenue loss, we are forced to transport everybody, and that includes the elementary students of non-public schools. That becomes a greater challenge for us because we don't want to say no to the non-public schools. We have a good working relationship with them, but at the same token, we, in this open enrollment environment, if we say no now, we know later on that Underwood and Rossay and other competing school districts will say yes, and so we transport. So we're in a bit of a bind, and I guess a little exhausting because over the course of the last 4 years, we've cut nearly $5 million out of our budget. And it doesn't seem like the non-public schools get to take some of the burden. As we raise fees for activities on our kids, access is reduced for those kids, but meanwhile the non-public schools continue to ride our bus. And so I can see it's starting to create a rift between our school board and the non-publics. And I know this proposal is supported by our MREA. We're just looking for a little bit of ability to share some of the load. That's all we're asking. So,
thank you, Mr. Maston. Mr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm from Anoka Hennepin. We have 28,500 students that ride our buses to and from school each day. We have 1,800 that ride to non-public schools, and we have about 1,000 students that we pay to go to non-public schools outside of our school district. Our school district has 5 high schools. Each high school averages about 35 square miles. So the students, we just travel in that area to take kids to the high schools. Our non-public schools, of 13 of them in our district, they have our school district as the attendance boundary, 172 square miles. So it's quite a difference for us in picking up and dropping off non-public students. There are 2 non-public schools in our district that we did split the attendance boundary, so that it's a bit smaller. We do things to try and reduce costs by having our non-public students ride high school buses and then shuttle to their non-public school, but that doesn't work for many of our students. For many of our non-public students, we need to go outside of attendance boundaries for high schools to go pick them up and take them to and from school. So we work very closely with our non-public schools. They're very good folks. They participate in our safety committees and coloring contests and all kinds of things, and we enjoy working with them. Just by the nature of where the students are and the numbers of students we have to transport, it's much more costly for us to do that. And actually, it wasn't until we got a call about what was the cost difference that we really put some costs together. And it took a little while to do that, but it's about $221 more than what we receive in state aid to transport each non-public student to and from school. And so that's where we arrived at our numbers, and I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, Madam Chair, I worked this summer, this interim, on this issue specifically, and Mr. Kite and many others joined me, Mr. Noel and many others in the area, in the sitting out in the audience, joined me in this difficult situation, and it is a difficult situation. And I think Mr. Kite said right off the bat, or somebody said right off the bat, if we didn't have this, if we had the Minnesota Miracle and we had the schools funded like we would have, we wouldn't be talking this. You know, as I tried to hold some interim meetings, I have some questions on the whole process here. And Mr. Paulson, you arrived at a figure of $221 additional cost per pupil for the non-publics?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Paulson.
Let me ask you, how did you, when we tried to do this summer, one of the most difficult problems was figuring out how much it costs. And you indicated, as you heard that request, how difficult it was to come up with a final figure. And let me ask you, just how did you come up with the final figure? And let me give you some additional things to think about. Your final figure, does that include the kids that were on those buses that were only private school kids, or were there private and public school kids on the bus? Because that plays a factor in the amount, in my opinion.
Right.
Do you do your you figuring on the number of miles, on the routes, on the hours? I think there's 3 different possibilities. So the way the districts decide their transportation dollars, and how does that impact the final figure? How much? As we sat in this committee, we tried to find out what is the true cost here. What is the true cost? Because if we're going to build that to charters or public, non-public. You know, I want to make sure that we are billing back a true figure if we're even going to do that. And I've got a couple other follow-ups. So I'll let you answer that to start with, if I can.
Mr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, there are 3 ways we transport non-public students to and from school. One is that they share a ride with a high school, and then they shuttle over. They also have a ride. Another option would be is they ride directly from their home to the non-public school if they live further away and it doesn't work with the high school. And the last way we transport students, we don't transport them. We pay them to drive, the parents drive them to the boundary to attend one of 72 non-public schools outside of our school district. So we kind of divided it into 3 different ways in which to determine it. And I took a sample. I didn't look at everybody. I took a sample and try to determine, and it chose it by how much we get charged to have a bus do a route, and then how many schools that route can do, and then how many students ride those routes and runs, so I tried to determine by either numbers of students on a portion of a run that gave me a cost per student, or if they're mixed with other groups of students, how many dollars it costs per student, and then took that up for the portion of the students that were in that bus. There's also some shuttles pieces that when we shuttle over, so that takes some time in a run that costs us to do that. So I tried to put some sort of method together, and actually the paying of students to go outside of the district brought our costs down, because we pay the family to drive. So it's not our cost, we pay them to drive, and that brought our costs down a little bit. So I hope that helps a little bit.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Paulson, that does help. Two more follow-ups. I don't know if any other members on this committee have been getting emails, but I've been getting emails on this issue.
Representative Ward, I can think we can vouch for all of us.
Okay. And Mr. Paulson, or any Representative Dabney or anybody, one of the things that the non-public folks make a good point on is there's 100,000 students, approximately non-public students, and let's just say that because of an additional cost that may be put on those folks, they may not be able to go to the non-public. And so let's just say that 2% of those folks go to a public setting. And that 2%, let's say the average student cost in Minnesota is $10,000. So, we might be talking $20 million here for just if 2% of those people go to the non-public school, the public. For what is perceived as what I have read as a $13 million problem. So please address the cost issue of putting another financial burden on our public school system based on what we maybe are going to do here.
Dr. Kite.
Representative Ward, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What Representative Ward is just describing right now is a state problem. But the problem we have is it's the school districts that are trying to pay it. If that is a legitimate argument, then perhaps the state, to keep children in the non-public schools, to simply pay the excess cost themselves to the public schools, then we would be neutral and we could do this job. So that argument kind of lends itself to a state solution, not a school district solution. The problem as we're describing it now is that the school districts are caught in the middle, getting some aid costs higher than that and having to pick up the difference and then cutting into other things that we'd like to do.
Thank you. I think that sums it up quite well. Representative Ward.
And Madam Chair, I hope this will be my last, maybe not. as I read the bill, Representative Dabney, it says that the school districts may bill back to the non-publics. So, for example, in my district, in both of my Brainerd and Crosby school districts, it would cost them more to process this than it would to recover the amount that they're going to lose, quite frankly. And they both said the status quo with them is fine. Mm-hmm. What's happening currently. So, does this bill, is it a mandate to all school districts? Does it allow school districts to be to voluntarily jump in here? I'll just leave it at that for now. Have an answer to that.
Dr. Kite.
Representative Ward, members of the committee. In fact, one of the school districts that we contacted about this, I believe it's Browerville, said to us, there is an excess cost to us, but we have a relationship in other ways that we would not want to do this. So making this permissive, I think, is a better solution than making it absolutely mandatory, because that puts it back on the local school districts to decide. We've got to balance financial pressures against hard feelings and other kinds of cooperation, and ultimately, I think they'll reach whatever the right solution is. But, if they have the permissive piece here, the argument now leaves you and goes to the school district to have to resolve it themselves.
Thank you, Dr.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I know that Mr. Lindell wanted to testify in support of the bill, and I believe there are others in the audience who may as well.
Representative Dabney, there are, and I have on the list Peter Knoll, Hannah Shagalow, Scott Kroonquist, Brad Lundell. Is there anyone else in the audience? And okay, Minneapolis, Jim Grathwall. So with that, I think we'll go to Representative Morgan.
I'll try to be very brief, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. This question is for Mr. Mazden, or there he is. Thank you. These numbers for Fergus Falls, and I guess for all the others here, are these numbers representing the cost to transport the charter and private school students in the district, the aid to transport those students, or is this for all of the students that you transport within your district?
The numbers you see here are just the non-public schools in my district.
And Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, so in your school district, the cost, the excess cost per student of $220, that represents the excess cost per charter or private school student. My question is, where does that money come from right now?
Right now,
Mr. Mastin.
My school district is paying that. Like Mr. Kite said, it would be nice to be able to have the ability to go back to the non-public schools and at least have the discussion with them that we are subsidizing this amount of money with them, and we can work it out from there.
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, in other words, that's $220 per student that you're transporting who does not attend the schools in your district that can't be spent educating the students who are attending the schools in your district.
That
Mr.
is
Mastin.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Slocum, Garofalo, and then we'll go to the testifiers. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me, there he is, Mr. Mastin, in Fergus Falls, how many charter schools do you have?
Mr. Mastin.
I have no charter schools in my district.
So you were talking...
Representative
Excuse
Slocum.
Me, Madam Chair. So you are talking about non-public schools, because charter schools, and I want to correct this because they've been lumped in here fairly frequently in the last 15 minutes or so with non-public schools. And I'm going to talk about non-public schools too. But charters are public schools, and I would like to get a legal read. Can a traditional public school district charge a public charter school for transport? Is it okay for a public school to charge a public school? And are these two separate, non-public transportation for non-public school kids and charter school, they're completely different things. I'm having a hard time making the connection legally.
I'm sorry?
Did you want to add?
No. I thought she was looking at staff for the legal definition, so I didn't see
if you want
to throw.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum. The bill covers both charter and non-public schools because traditional public schools are obligated to provide transportation to both. As you may know, in fact, in the case of charter schools, traditional public school districts are mandated to provide transportation options that may be more robust to the charter school students than they provide their own. For instance, my own school district this year went through a very painful process of restructuring transportation routes in the district and attendance boundaries in order to save money. But a charter school student still, under state law, can be transported anywhere within the entire geography of the school district. That obviously yields greater expense. And I'll ask staff to correct me, but in about 1996, I believe, what had been a categorical aid for transportation was rolled into the formula. And I was not a member at that time, but was an education activist with my union. And part of the explanation we received at the time was by rolling transportation costs into the formula, you were consciously, as a policy matter, pitting the cost of transporting the child against the cost of the textbooks, against the cost of the food in the cafeteria, against the cost of the staff salaries. You were forcing efficiencies in the traditional public schools. But here we have a situation, and choices. Here we have a situation that choices outside the district, the traditional districts, get pitted against the cost of textbooks, food for the cafeteria, staff salaries, and everything else. So I do think that the charter schools and non-public because of the similarity in treatment in state law, belong in the same bill.
And members, this is similar to the bill that we discussed a lot last year that Representative Newton had, if not the same bill. And we're trying to not have something less for one group of students, but equal. This is equal, and when you have more for some and less for others, then they have to make cuts in other areas. Your last question, Representative Slocum, and then we'll go to Representative Garofalo.
Should we then be looking at also including open enrollment students, because they are non-traditional, and they're bused even outside the traditional district?
Representative Dabney.
Interesting conversation. I don't have an answer.
I'd love to have that one.
Put himself to the border, don't they? Open enrollment. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, with our open enrollment statutes, essentially the requirement is for the serving district from the border in. So it's a little bit of a different situation than with the charters. But with open enrollment, the requirement is on the serving district from the border of that district in, not from the leaving district from the border of the district out.
We're going to run short of time, but Representative Dabney, since you're the author, and I'll call on you briefly, but we have Representative Garofalo and six testifiers. Representative Dabney.
For Mr. Strom, then. So in that case, the district, the entity that is receiving the state formula monies is the bearer of the cost of the transportation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, yes.
Thank you. So there's the difference.
Representative Garofalo, you've got a minute or so, and then we're going to go to testifiers. Right. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just 2 points. Number one, Representative Ward's totally right. I don't know how you can possibly figure out what their costs are for these items in every single situation. But secondly, for those involving the costs of non-public school students, I understand, and whether it's a subsidy or a cost, there's no doubt the public school system is providing some benefit to non-public school students, and there's a cost there. I don't dispute that. However, for there not to be a fiscal note with this bill is just silly. Clearly, if non-public school students' parents are going to start paying these costs out of their pocket, there's going to be more students in the public school system. If there are more students in the public school system, we will have an extra cost at the state of Minnesota. This bill, while it may relieve a mandate at the local level, will cost the state of Minnesota's budget money. And at a time, everyone knows our situation, we can't be spending any more on anything. So I'd be very curious, not now, but at some point in the future, to find out how there is any rational justification for this bill not having a fiscal note. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Mr. Noel and Hannah Shagalow, if the two of you could come up together. We've got 15 minutes, five people, and since that was the presenters of those for the bill, I'll give the two of you 2 to 3 minutes and the others 1 to 2. So whoever's first. Mr. Noel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Pete Noel. I'm with the Minnesota Catholic Conference Education Director, and the purpose of my testimony today is to oppose House File 2910. Basically, what happens here, in our estimation, is that it places new restrictions and limitations on non-public and charter school students for being transported to their schools. And we contend that any diminishment or elimination, ultimately, of equal transportation to children attending charter schools and public non-public schools, including the assessment of riders' fees, would clearly set up more constraints and barriers to parental choice in education. Also, any diminishment of these transportation services compromises the safety of Minnesota's children, particularly those in this situation that would be attending non-public or charter schools. In fact, I believe that was the original intent of pupil transportation, was for the safety and efficiency of transporting children to and from school. These non-public school families that were characterized by an earlier testifier as not having taken as much of a hit, I think, is to me, a little disingenuous to that, because there's rising costs in non-public schools as well, and these families pay for that out of their discretionary income. And I have spent some time on this issue, as Representative Ward has indicated, about the effect, the impact, the ramifications of this. And I do believe that it could ultimately actually add to the state deficit by requiring de facto more private school students to have to not be in their school of choice, but to matriculate in the public school. And there's no question in my mind that this is going to be a tipping point for many, many parents. And as Representative Dabney mentioned, referred to the non-public and charter schools as a competition. That's fair, but let's keep the playing field level then. Let's not make the playing field advantage for one system over the other then. Let's make it a true parental choice. So, Madam Chair, I conclude my testimony and stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Noel. Ms. Shagalow.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Hannah Shagalow, and I'm the director of SHARIM. SHARIM is a centralized agency that provides special education services to students at all of the Jewish educational programs in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I have prepared remarks, but before I take the committee's time, I would like to verify one thing. I'm coming before you with a question, and my question is, will this legislation impact transportation for services for people with disabilities, students in my organization, in my program, who need to be transported from non-public to public school for special education services? I'm assuming it does not impact, but I'm asking clarification for all the families that we do service who do have children that ride the bus back and forth on a daily basis.
Representative Dabney.
Let me assure the testifier in the committee that this does not affect special education transportation or excess cost transportation.
Ms. Shagalow.
I guess I'm done.
Oh, okay. All right, questions then for Mr. Noel. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noel, do your families, they work in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Noel.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum, do they work in the state of Minnesota?
The families that go to your schools.
Yes, I think to the proportion that families that attend public schools would work in the state of Minnesota, yes.
Do they pay income
Representative
tax?
Slocum, could you go through the chair,
I will
please?
Do that, I'm sorry.
And we're not going to have a big, long
no,
debate
it's
here.
Not.
We've got to be
very quick.
Testifiers. Okay,
very
Representative Slocum.
Madam Chair, do your non-public school parents pay property taxes in this state?
Mr. Noel.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum, the answer to that is affirmative.
So we have
Representative Slocum, if you
mad.
Could go through this chair.
I'm so sorry, Madam Chair.
Slocum.
I owe you one. So we have people who have chosen to go to non-public schools. Not charter schools, because they're public schools, but non-public schools. They're paying income taxes in this state. They're paying property taxes in this state. They're not getting a nickel, basically, except for transportation to their school for their tax dollars. You'd think I was from Stearns County, but I'm not. but I just, they're not getting their money's worth because they made a choice to send their kids to non-public schools. This is the only thing they get for property taxes. They're paying school levies in their districts. They're citizens in their districts, and they pay income taxes. They're getting nothing.
Okay, thank you, Representative Slocum. Any other comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Dr. Noel and I are having a conversation up here.
Okay.
That I thought I'd share with the audience. The state provides textbooks for non-public schools. It provides special education services for non-public schools. It provides health services for non-public schools. So a contention that the only thing that non-public school families get from their taxes is transportation to school is, as Dr. Noel will admit, not a correct contention.
Okay. Madam Chair. And we're going to, and I'll call on you just 1 second, but we'll, I'd like to keep this to transportation. If we're going to get into public, private payments, I could have a big debate on that. I would, I'm a big stickler for separation of church and state, and if you make private choices, you go to Barnes & Noble. If you want public choices, you go to the public library, and you have a right to do both, but you don't expect someone to buy your books at Barnes & Noble. That's my philosophy. But right now, we're only talking about transportation, so let's try to stick with that. And Dr. Noll, I'm apologize for not calling you Dr. Noll. You could make one comment, and then we'll bring up the last three. Dr. Noll.
Could you accord me two comments, Madam Chair?
Please, yes.
All right. The one would be just clarification about what Representative Dabney mentioned. He's absolutely correct on that regarding textbook aid, health services, and so forth. But let me clarify that that amount comes to, per student that applies for it, and they do have to apply for it, about $200 for the textbook aid and health services. I think I'm actually a little high on that. That's excluding guidance and counseling, which is available for students in grades 8 through 12. And that's about $192 a student.
I've forgotten about
again. And the other thing, you know, and this question occurred to me, and I find Representative Biskins very quotable, and I too am not an attorney, but I, you know, it occurred to me as I was listening to the earlier testifiers, the origins of this piece of legislation, at least my understanding, a layman's understanding of this, is that it was for the benefit of the child, a child benefit to be transported to school, not per se a benefit to the non-public school. So where I'm leading with this is, and I'm sure I have a great respect for the revisor's office, I know they vet things very thoroughly, but if then the school is going to be billed for excess costs that aren't paid by the parents that are matriculated in the non-public school, how does that work constitutionally?
Well, Dr. Noll, that's a, I think you meant rhetorical, and I think we'll probably find out the answer if we go to that. But I think Representative Ward summed it up best. You know, when there's plenty of money, nobody worries about all these things. When there isn't, we start to have to define exactly what is the mission of the public state dollar, and that's the discussion we're having today. None of us like it, but we're having it, and sometimes that does involve constitutional challenges. So we'll see where we go with this, but I appreciate that question. I think it is a question that we might get answered before we get done here. So we've got three more testifiers, and we've got 5 minutes. Mr. Kronquist, Mr. Lundell, and Mr. Grafwall, and if the first one or two take up all the time, we won't get to the last one. Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee member Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. You know, it's disappointing that this started to break down into a public-private discussion, because that's not at all, I don't think, what the reason it was brought forward. I know Representative Dabney didn't bring it forward in that light, and we aren't supporting it in that light. But I will tell you the light we are supporting it in. I represent 33 school districts. This year, those 33 districts reduced their budgets by $85 million and laid off 900 staff. All right, that's going to look like the good days when we start next year rolls around. We did an early projection. They're still putting their budgets together, as you know, but the early projections are those 33 school districts are going to face $150 million in budget reductions next year. The message I've gotten from all of you is to come forward with ideas that don't cost state money, and then Representative Benson and Tilbury are, and many of the rest of you are looking at mandate reduction task force. We got to look at those things. This is one idea. If someone's got a better idea, we're all ears. The state can pay for it, that'd be great. If you want to grant levy authority for it, that'd be great. But the reality is that traditional public school students, parents, pay by and large for transportation.
And this is just, I think, leveling the playing field. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Kronquist. Mr. Lundell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation. We are supporting Senator Representative Dabney's bill. Sorry for the insult there. But I would say that the much of what's been said here, I think going back to is when you're with me, you're riding in the Wayback Machine. But when the roll-in of transportation back in 1995 for fiscal 96, there would have been, that wouldn't have solved this completely, but there was a venue there where you could talk about special transportation needs district to district that could take care of. But clearly, districts throughout the state are running deficits in their total transportation budgets. This is another deficit for many of those districts, and just adds to more and more transportation costs coming out of the general fund, and you've got to move the kids. With that, I'll just turn the rest of my time over to Mr. Grathwell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grathwell.
Madam Chair and members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. Representative Dabney is an excellent author. This is a fantastic bill I have in my hand. For the committee, it's just a breakout. We can cost out transportation quite easily. I just want you to know that the policies you enact actually have costs associated with them. And what this bill does is improve accountability and transparency about where those costs are borne. And the the premise of the bill is where we have greater choice, there is greater cost, and those making those choices should bear the brunt of, should pay those costs. Punto final. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grathwell. Representative Dabney, a closing statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question before us is not should the state participate in the transportation of students across the state, regardless of what school they choose. School choice is a policy, it's a practice, and it's a value. It's who should pay for the costs associated with those choices that is the question before this committee.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And did I hear you say also for the record, we heard testimony from some of the school district groups, but that MREA also supports your bill?
That was the message of one of the testifiers, yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 2910 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the meeting is adjourned. Oh.